Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
All right, welcome back to another episode of Friends from Work, a podcast about all things in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and it's a podcast that's hosted by myself, Kyle Schoenewill, and my longtime friend from work, Robbie Earle. Yes, I am rushing through that intro. Why am I rushing through the intro? Cry Man Squad, FNC, double time. In the words of Michael Scott, Crisis Management Squad, front and center, twice as fast as we normally would go. Could you argue that I'm wasting time explaining all of this? Yes. But we have been looking forward to rewatching Thor: Love and Thunder for over a year now. Because every time we watch it, Robbie and I pick up something new. And mostly this podcast was originally started at its core to hopefully find some new things from films that maybe you didn't appreciate as much and add to your appreciation with those films. And today is a perfect example of us getting back to our core principles. Because we have so much to say, and due to our schedules, we have a hard out in 1 hour. So this episode needs to be under an hour. We are going to waste no time. We are going to do 2 parts of Thor: Love and Thunder, our rewatch that we did last week. And so, Robbie, that's my long-winded intro to say, let's get right into Thor: Love and Thunder, shred fest and all. I want to try to learn that guitar solo, by the way. That's my new mission.
Oh, you can do it.
I don't know. The shredding at the end. Okay. Hi. Let's do it, baby.
Man. Okay. So, yeah, let's just jump into this because I have been looking forward since I kind of did my first rewatch building out the Phase 4 order. I have been wanting to talk to you for longer about this. And, yeah, it's been a long time. So, I guess I want to start with this realization that I've had more recently, that this movie is a lot more than I thought it was.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like, in a lot of ways, I think to kind of start with, I think whenever I first saw this, you and I had conversations, even in the lead up to Love and Thunder, about is Taika going to do the thing that James Gunn arguably did in Guardians 2 by just dialing everything up to 11 and then it kind of messing with the balance. And I think that I came away from Love and Thunder initially thinking, yeah, there's a little bit of that. Like there is a bit of oh, look, this works. This is funny. Now just go all the way with it. And now it's too much. And I think that you can make an argument that there are maybe elements of that, but I think that misunderstands what's going on here. I don't think that this was Taika kind of losing his hold on the MCU or the particular formula that had worked for Ragnarok. I think that almost everything that we see here that's super, super goofy, I think is super goofy for a reason. Once you see that, whether you like it or not, and I should always clarify, this is not me saying if you don't like this movie that you're
an idiot.
It's just, I think that, again, like you always say, humor is such a subjective thing,
right?
That when you have a movie that is so much a comedy for, you know, a lot of it, you are going to turn certain people off. And so if it's not your style of humor, it's just not going to be your style of humor. But I think that there's a difference between saying like, oh, man, look at Taika. He's just missing the mark because none of this stuff is funny. And that's all the movie's trying to do. And so because it didn't do that, it's a failure. And saying like, well, I don't laugh at these jokes, but what's going on here? And is, you know, I think that there maybe is a message hidden in there. We maybe hinted at this when we were first covering the movie. Just like Ragnarok was really interested in exploring the idea of Thor as a king, of Asgard as kind of the seat of an empire and imperialism in general and what that looks like. I think this movie is taking a deeper dive than I initially thought into what it looks like for Thor to be a god of thunder and what it looks like for there to be a god of anything.
Your initial premise is this movie is doing more than people originally thought, ourselves included. And
right.
buckle up, give us a shot, give us one chance to try to explain why we feel that way.
Yes. So,
by the way, comedy is just hard in general. It's so right. difficult because as soon as you make a comedy film, you're immediately ruling out, I would say, 30% of the audience who just for whatever reason isn't going to think it's funny. I mean, we actually had a discussion right. about this on Discord, not specifically this film, but the fact that last week I told people that I hadn't seen Deadpool and that typically that style of movie is just not really my humor. Mm-hmm. And I just realized, like, you know, that's everybody with some movie, right? Some people think The Other Guys isn't funny, and I can't wrap my right. mind around how you don't think that's funny. Some people are going to find this movie funny and others aren't. And so no matter what, when you add a lot of humor, it rules some people out. But
stick
with us. Even if you don't think it's funny, let us point out some of the things that this movie is actually doing really great besides mm-hmm. the humor.
This movie actually answers a lot of questions that have been hanging out there prior to even Infinity War and Endgame to some degree. Things that came up via Ragnarok, things that came up just because of the way that the Thor franchise was kind of fractured early on. The first obvious thing it does is it takes Thor from where we left him at Endgame and kind of gets him back to the version of Thor that is recognizable, that can then be like back in the MCU toy box in more or less his like standard form. I appreciate that Thor is acting so weird for the first half, and that turned a lot of people off. Mm-hmm. But you go back to Infinity War and Endgame, and you kind of see the break, and it would be so weird for Thor to come out of that and revert to like a prior, you know, pre-Infinity War version. Or, you know, certainly a pre-Ragnarok version. So I think that it makes sense that you're right. Like, we find him having kind of gotten back physically, but he's acting pretty similarly to how he acted in Endgame, which is just like, he's compensating with humor and bravado, but he's like clearly lost and doesn't really know who he is or where he's anchored. And I think that is fitting, because if you look at Endgame, like, we always said that if that were to be the end of Thor, I think you would kind of assume, oh, he went off somewhere and he like found himself again, and that would have been fine. But if you're going to pick back up with that character, Endgame did not leave him in any definitive place. Basically, all he had realized is that he isn't tethered to the version of himself that he's been, or that he thought he had to be. For the rest of the time we've known him. And so I think it makes sense that now we pick back up with him trying to figure out, well, then who am I? And asking these questions about how his role as a god plays into that, how his role as a hero plays into that. And then it kind of leading back to him asking these questions about love and about kind of what makes life meaningful.
I have stuff I want to add to that then. I totally agree. I think the difference subtly is just how the Russos versus how Taika handle the humor in and of itself. So I think he's in a very similar place from the MCU perspective, but those subtle differences are just the differences in the directors and the writers to me. So if you trace Thor's story going all the way back, you know, you had this guy who was full of bravado, super intense, wanted only to be king and to rule. He gets slowly humbled, meets Jane over the first couple films. And then you start this trajectory of he becomes all powerful, but even while he becomes all powerful, he loses everything. and his power doesn't prevent him from all the pain and loss. So then you go through this trajectory of he loses in Infinity War and he loses in Ragnarok. And then he comes back from that and handles it in the way he does, which is he drinks, he doesn't take care of his body, he kind of gives up hope, and he's hurting inside in Endgame. And I think this actually is a perfect continuation of that, where yes, now he was at the bottom. At the very end of Endgame, he starts getting healed a little bit, but now this is a guy who has nothing. He has none of his friends, he doesn't have any of his family, he doesn't have his planet, he's not a king, and he's lost all that stuff. And I'm with you a little bit that this is kind of the next logical step for him as a character, right? Like the overcompensating, the overjoking, the bravado of ripping off the shirt and standing there as like a big entrance. And they literally, via Korg, explain at the beginning of the film, like where he's at. They explain that he doesn't know anything else. So now he just sits and waits to be asked for the next battle and say, Thor, we need your help, because he doesn't know what else to do. And so I actually on this watch agree. I picked up on that more than ever before. It is funny. And for me, it's a little bit too goofy at times. He's a little bit too quote unquote dumb in the beginning. We've talked about that ad nauseum in the past, but yes, I see what they're doing. Like it makes sense. He's lost, he's hurting, and he doesn't know where to go.
And what I appreciate is it almost makes it an inverse journey from the one that Taika took him on in Ragnarok, where in that movie, it starts with Thor, like he's sort of got it all together. I mean, he's lost his mom in the Dark World. But aside from that, it's like he's Asgard, as far as he knows, when Ragnarok starts, is in good shape, and Odin's there, and he's like, he's beaten Ultron, and things are good on Earth. And then he's out trying to find the Infinity Stones, and he's just, we open that movie with him talking about what heroes do, and it's just like a, we are introduced to classic Thor at the start of Ragnarok, and by the end of that movie, his hair is cut and he's lost an eye and Asgard has exploded and Odin's dead. And it's like he's had to kind of lose everything, and in doing that has figured out what it is to actually be the king of Asgard. But it's like my point being, it's a deconstruction. And I think here we have a construction where we're starting with him kind of being in a spot of having been beaten down even further than where he was at the end of Ragnarok. And then we get the chance to kind of see him build back up. And in that way, I think that this movie is from almost a classic sense, a comedy as opposed to a tragedy, in that it's moving ultimately towards a resolution, even though this movie, I think, pulls on your heartstrings more so than even Ragnarok did. We get the chance to see Thor kind of reclaim a lot, like everything that he has lost, not just in Ragnarok, but through the entire journey through the Infinity Saga. We see him kind of re-explore piece by piece and regain, but in new ways. And so it's like we talk about with this idea of moving up the mountain in circles, where he's reaching the same spot, but from a higher perspective. Just from the MCU, like, what are we doing with Thor's story? I think that to look at this and say, oh man, this is just Taika trying to make Thor super funny and missing the mark, is to really, I think it's not to give this a fair shot and to give Taika credit, because I don't think that, like, there's a way to read this as Taika just phoning it in and not caring, and I just want to be goofy, because he kind of, he has that, that's his shtick.
Okay, that was going to be my follow-up point. I was going to say part of the problem there, I think, is that as a human being, Taika has only leaned into that. So anytime you watched any of the marketing of the behind the scenes, it was like Taika being Taika. It was being so goofy. It's him being like, oh no, it's just me making a comedy and I don't know what I'm doing in the MCU. And like, that was all, like that was the entire marketing plan. And I think in a weird way, it sells himself short. And you say, well, oh, Kyle and Robbie, you're just reading all of that into a film that he was not trying to do that. He was clearly just being goofy. How do you know that that's at all what he was intending to do? And talk about some of the thematic elements we're going to talk about. Well, I know that because I've seen his other movies. Right. Go watch Jojo Rabbit and tell me he doesn't have thought or care. Go watch Ragnarok and tell me he's not thinking of what he's doing. So he almost hurts his own case. He hurts his own case with that. But I'm with you. I think all that stuff is in there. And by the way, following up on the MCU-ness, you talked about Thor and his journey, but we're underselling what it actually does for Valkyrie, for New Asgard, and for Jane.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I was like, about to hit Jane.
Well, so the MCU-ness of it is also advanced in a lot of other ways besides just Thor's character.
Right. Well, and I'm glad you took us there, because I think one of the big questions that Taika himself kind of asked and then now answers here is, I remember when Ragnarok came out, everyone was like, what is this jump from a version of Thor that we knew even in Age of Ultron to now he's like speaks slightly differently? And I remember watching behind the scenes stuff in Ragnarok and them talking about him getting kind of a different dialect coach, or maybe the same dialect coach, but a different approach in what they were trying to get from him, less Shakespearean and kind of leaning more into his Australian / Taika's New Zealand accent. But I think that was always like, okay, this is such a different version of the character. Are we just going to say that this is a different take on him, or is there some kind of in-universe explanation? And I remember at the time, or whenever we were doing the rewatch, talking about what could have happened that would have led him to be more, talk more like a human and less like an Asgardian. But here, Taika kind of makes it explicit. Like he goes back and talks about his relationship with Jane, and there's a line where he says that Thor taught Jane the way of the warrior.
Oh,
and
yeah.
She taught Thor the way of the people. And you see him going out to dinner with her and going to parties with her. And you realize that in the time between Thor the Dark World and Thor Ragnarok, including time before and after Age of Ultron, I think, based on the way that montage goes, it would make sense. He's for the first time in his life spending a ton of time in the company of people in a different, like not as the God of Thunder or as an Asgardian, but just as kind of a person. But then also I think that to your point about the Jane of it all, that was the big thing that was kind of dangling. Like this was a character that was introduced in the first scene of the first Thor movie. And we never really knew what happened to her. We haven't heard anything about her other than like one quick aside in Ragnarok. And Endgame, I guess. I feel like not only does this answer those questions of where Jane has been, I think another thing that it does really well that I appreciate is it explains why it's Jane that becomes Thor, which is something that I don't think the comic from Jason Aaron actually ever really did. Like in the comic, it was just there must always be a Thor. And so because it's not Thor and because Jane is an existing character within that mythos, it was fun to make it her. And that I'm not trying to minimize how that story was told, because I think Jason Aaron did a great job. But here it actually makes more sense, and it fits into the theme of the entire film that we'll talk about in a second by hooking it into Thor wanting to protect Jane and kind of giving that charge to Mjolnir, where now it's like it's not just a random thing where Jane is worthy and therefore Jane should be Thor. It's like it is that, but it's also baked into this idea that that's how Mjolnir works, that's how Jane and Thor's relationship works. So it's all like, to me, remarkably symmetrical. Like I think that it makes a certain sense that is easy to miss maybe if you haven't thought about it as much as I have, which is probably too much. But I think that those to me are everything that we've talked about so far in terms of just those characters moving forward. I feel like are all both like important and impressive in the way that they're handled.
Wow. He's back, baby. He's back, ladies and gentlemen. This is a meat and potatoes vegetables, broccoli, squash type episode. I mean, there's just no nonsense here. I totally agree. I don't have anything to add.
This movie is almost everything that he's doing comes from Jason Aaron, which is kind of crazy. Like, it's not, I mean, Gore is a Jason Aaron character and story. Jane Foster as Thor is a Jason Aaron character and story. But Jason Aaron is such a kind of like, I love Vikings guy. Like,
yeah, it's very Space Vikings.
Like, he can be really funny. So I don't want to take that away from him, but it is like a, when you read these, you're reading like a, you know, like a manly Thor, not a kind of funny, silly Thor.
That's good to know. And here, honestly, that probably influences some people's opinions on the film, right?
Absolutely. And again, you know, I think one thing that's worth noting is Jason Aaron was in fact a consultant on this movie.
We met him.
We did meet him in line at the premiere.
Yeah. So he was there.
But
he's a part of this.
he's a part of it, and he has said that they took some of his suggestions, though not all of them. But I think that one, it's a really interesting way to do an adaptation. We've talked about how I think that it's about finding the things within that story that are true and carrying those forward without feeling like you have to be a slave to every detail in terms of the execution.
Right.
I think that's happening here. It's also, this is a very, because of what Taika's doing thematically, but also just because of the version of Thor he's exploring, it's a really heightened reality within this MCU. Like, it's a very comic booky, like a colorful, reminiscent of Multiverse of Madness in that way.
Don't say heightened reality. We don't know what it means. Okay.
It's like, it's a, like what I mean is, it's clear that this movie is not.
I know what you mean.
It's not operating in the same world that Civil War is.
Right.
Even
it's
though
a space
it is.
Opera. Yeah. It's a space yeah. opera. Colors, the ideas. Yeah.
And so it's introducing, I think, not introducing, but emphasizing something that we see more in the comics that we are now seeing make its way into the MCU, which is this idea that you are going to have different creators take on the same properties. And when you do that, yes, everything is canon, right? Like, yes, everything that happened in Civil War or in Thor the Dark World or however you want to look at it did happen in this same universe. But also, people are acting in a way here that is so yes. extreme and so mm-hmm. different. So again, I don't want to, I understand why that would be a turnoff to people, but I think that that is a choice. And I think that that's something that we need to kind of.
It's distracting people from some of these other great points.
Well, and it's a big change from the Infinity Saga. Like Ragnarok did this a bit. Generally, like the window was smaller. Like, yes, you would have some movies that were funnier and some movies that were darker, but I think that like the space between those was less. Whereas I think now, as we're getting into phase four, for better or worse, you're getting a lot, like it's a wider spectrum. You know, you can either be into that or not, but I say all this because I feel like that is where we get into the movie making of it, like some of the okay. choices that he took. And so I am curious to hear what your nitty gritty points are.
Okay, since we're on the clock, first of all, let me say you were talking about Jason Aaron. Check out organicpricebooks.com if you want to read more Jason Aaron comics. That's what you should do. And I love True. That I've been seeing people using our promo code in these emails yeah. I've been getting. So yes, promo code Friends From Work. Check out more comics at organicpricebooks.com. You've heard us talk about them a lot. But I think this is perfect. Let's do 5 minutes on just a couple nitty gritty details here. Then we'll take a quick break. And when we come back, I want to hear all about the thematic side of Thor, Love, and Thunder and finish up with, if it's not your number one film in the MCU, where could it have improved? Like, why not? And we'll finish with a tiny little mm-hmm. caveat there. But for the most part, I love you taking the lead here. I mean, this is like me last week. It's the total inverse. Okay, just really briefly, small things. I can't emphasize how powerful the first like 10 minutes of the film are to start with Gore in the way they do.
Mm-hmm.
I've said before, for whatever reason, because I'm a dad with a young daughter about that age, I have a legitimate hard time watching the intro of this film. I did when we first saw it, but now that I have a daughter, it's even worse. And I don't know. It's so heartbreaking to me. And that's what Taika does best. I remember I said this in the original episode, but remember we had all that metal music and the lasers going at the world premiere and all this stuff. And then there's no previews or there's no intro. The curtain goes up and it's that start. And we were all just stunned that they're starting the film the first 5 minutes with like with that kind of pain and heartbreak.
Right.
But it lays the foundation perfectly for the end of the film. The second thing I want to point out there is it goes immediately from Gore confronting that god, getting the Necro Sword, which I want to reel back. I don't think it's ever as goofy as I thought. I think I was a little bit weirded out by like the flowers that could talk and stuff. But to your point, you just said, yeah, it's just that it's a different, it lives in a different world. It's doing a different thing. And so I think the first time you see it, that's a little bit like, whoa, what? But on subsequent watches, every time I watch it, I'm like, the god's not saying anything goofy. He's horrible. He's saying the worst things you could possibly say to a human in this, you know, position, having just lost his daughter and starving to death. And it makes you so mad, which is exactly the point, right? It's supposed to make your blood boil and make you feel why Gore is going to do this, right? You get it. And then I think it's just, I think it was just a tone setter for the uniqueness of the choices of like the flowers talking. And I just don't feel as weird about it now as I did then. But then you get the whole intro to Thor and what he's been doing with the Guardians, which is funny, but it is laying the groundwork for what we just talked about, that he's overcompensating, too much bravado. This is clear. Like, it's so over the top that if you don't walk away with that being your takeaway, then I think you're missing the point. Like, it, he's intentionally making it so ridiculous with the splits, not just for humor, but also to show you that, like, yes, it's funny, but he's in a weird spot. Clearly, that's the whole point of it. And the fact that on this watch, I notice how much the people he's quote unquote saving are not very thankful to him because he's in this spot. The god of destruction is what they call him the last time when they walk up. And Thor is kind of missing that, that I think there's even more going on there than I originally thought, because I was just distracted by the lasers and the weird furry people. And
by the way, to that point, like I think that that also kind of makes sense with where we left Thor, because you look back at Endgame, one of the last moments we got with him was trying to be the one that got to snap and trying to show that he was so strong and he could do it all. And now it's like, yeah, he is physically able to do it. So he is so overdoing it in every way all the time.
Right. But then my favorite call of this intro is Thor goes, another classic Thor adventure. And he raises his axe and the camera pans up. And you've brought this up before. As it pans up, I have chills right now. It just goes to Jane in the, what is it? The CAT scan machine.
The MRI.
The MRI. What a genius turn. I mean, it goes from Thor totally overcompensating, all this bravado, totally missing the point and being like classic Thor adventure, to immediately like, while you're doing this, Thor, this is the kind of stuff you're missing on. Like, this is the stuff you're missing. Jane is going through stage 4 cancer. You're not there. You're overcompensating with this other stuff. And I love the tonal shift of how serious it gets for a second there. And really shows Jane kind of overcompensating by not wanting to sit through the chemo. And again, where I think Taika does a good job is he balances the lack of humor there. It's not like Darcy comes in with a big joke. I was very nervous that Darcy, there's a moment where she goes, how you doing? And for a second, I thought she was going to be like, you know, and make some goofy comment right there, but it's not. She says like, so how you doing? Because she feels uncomfortable that Jane's not getting it. So there's a little bit of Taika lets the moment sit more than we all originally thought the first time without humor.
No, I totally agree. Again, it is a comedy and a lot of, for a lot of this movie is a comedy. Portions of it definitely aren't, but as a whole, like, yes, he's clearly trying to get laughs. I do laugh at a lot of it, but I also think that those jokes are very intentionally placed. And you're right. Like, I think that the kind of the comedy of like another classic Thor adventure and, oh, he tore down all this stuff, but it's like just Thor being goofy. Yeah. Juxtaposed. That is, I think probably for some people, jarring and looks like bad filmmaking, but I just feel the exact opposite. Like I think that that's a, I mean, that's the thing. You said this in your movie club look at Jojo Rabbit before Love and Thunder came out. Gosh, like that is the Taika thing. It's that constant juxtaposition of the tragic and the absurd.
Well, and he makes it jarringly quick. That is his shtick.
Right.
He's going to go from Jojo chasing a butterfly to, and I'm not going to spoil it, but the most shocking visual of the film in literally a frame. And he does that kind of here with this. Classic Thor adventure, Jane has stage four cancer. And there's no, and that's his thing. I love it because I find myself going like, haha, classic Thor. Frick. And I think that's really powerful. Two more filmmaking things, then we're getting to the thematic elements. On this watch, I think I undersold the differences in the way that Christian Bale is acting gore with the sword and without the sword.
Yes.
I never caught that before, but like, okay, the intro is clearly gore, not infected or poisoned by this disease from the sword. And so he cares for his daughter. He sees the gun and goes like, oh my goodness, like it's so good to see you. Like you need to say, but my Lord, there's not people to save anymore, to worship you, blah, blah. It's very, and then as soon as the sword infects him, you actually see it. That's when you hear him talk differently. His voice changes. Then that whole middle of the film that I used to complain about how he's a little bit too much goofy, like the Joker almost. Well, that's him clearly being poisoned by this sword. And then I didn't really catch that the second that sword gets destroyed and he's in eternity, it's short. But that whole last tidbit, he doesn't talk like that or act like that again.
Oh, yeah. And his teeth are back to normal. Like the character design shifts.
And I think I just viewed it the first time as like, man, he's playing this a little too zany for me.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm like, oh, that was even intentional by him and by Taika. The sword is what's making him zany. Right. And the snake stuff, you know, cutting off the head and, you know, and the way he talks and your God's betrayed, you know, that kind of stuff. But then all of a sudden he gets really normal at the end. So I undersold that. And then my last thing, I took an actual note. From 1 hour and 11 minutes, 71 minutes and 55 seconds into this film, the last whatever it takes from that point on, this is a top five MCU film for me.
Wow. Okay. I like that.
Now, one could argue like what happened that it took 71 minutes to get to that point, but
sure.
At 71 minutes and 55 seconds is when Jane says to Thor, I have cancer, just out of nowhere. And from that moment on, Thor never makes a silly comment or joke the rest of the film. That is the shift in Thor's character, which now that I've watched this a bunch of times, I realize how beautifully paced that is actually, that he finally gets to this point of accepting, like that is his growth moment. He's gone from all the over bravado we talked about, but at 71 minutes, it hits him and he changes. And the back half of this film, not only the action, not only the way Gore changes his acting, but the way Thor now is a different human, that conversation with Jane, I have chills right now, at the hospital bed, and then the whole ending of the film in eternity, and even the way they sum it up back on New Asgard, it's all perfect. That's one of my favorite films in the MCU from that point on. And I think there's crazy beauty in the subtlety of that shift. So I have a couple critiques from before that, but I was just struck by how moved I was from that moment. So those are my three quick little filmmaking caveats I wanted to follow up on since the first time we talked about this movie.
And I think, because I was looking for that too, the moments we do get from Thor that have a bit of comedy in them, it feels like what I like is it's not such a, it is a subtle shift. It's not so jarring that it's like now Thor is like, fully Thor the Dark World version, like in the darkest parts of that movie, but it is like comedy from Ragnarok and before, where it's like you have those kind of moments of like Thor not knowing how a vending machine works.
Yes.
That feels very classic Thor, like first two Thor films.
But yeah, it's totally different humor. You're right. That's like a, Thor is aware of the fact that he doesn't know it's a vending machine in that joke. Whereas like before that, he's so overcompensating that I don't know that he is self-aware that he's coming across like that.
Right.
So
right.
He's allowed to make a joke. And from 71 minutes on, he does make a joke, but it's not, he's not the butt of the joke in his lack of awareness.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I think it's, I still think Endgame is so instructive in that. Like you can look at the way he's introduced in that scene when Bruce first goes to his place in New Asgard, and the mannerisms that Hemsworth kind of finds there in that version of Thor, you see a lot slightly differently again, like we said, but you see those all through the first half of this movie, and you don't really see those after. Like the kind of like it's, and again, I we haven't said this yet, so I want to shout out Chris Hemsworth's performance in this film, because I think that can also get lost. He comes to this with a lot of nuance.
Oh, it's unbelievable. You're so right. I used to just think about kind of the comedy bits, and those are funny to me, sometimes over the top, sometimes don't work. But dude, again, from that 71 minute mark, I don't think, and we'll talk about this in a second, I don't think the final sequence with Jane could have been acted better by anybody else. It's so perfect. Yeah. The four of them at the end. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, this is what we're going to do. We're going to talk about the thematic elements of him being a god. We're going to talk about movies that make us cry legitimately. And then we'll talk about a couple of the concerns from the film after a quick word from these sponsors. All right, this is an actual challenge to us. Can we finish this in 20 to 30 minutes, Robbie? That's our goal. We have a hard out. We got to be really succinct with our answers. I agree with Thor's acting. Let's go. Talk to me about the godness of this film and some of the deeper layers that Taika is putting into this film that maybe you didn't catch the first time.
So in the same way that Ragnarok, I think every time we see when we see Asgard, like the first time we see it in that film, it's Loki pretending to be Odin, and he's sitting there and he's eating his grapes, and they're putting on this like indulgent play, and everything's gold, and it's such a kind of damning look at those in power and what the people that are supposed to be ruling are actually doing. And then, you know, we delve into all that via Hela. Here, you kind of set this up earlier. We have the same thing, but it's much more focused. And I think just as a whole, one realization I had, I still love Ragnarok a ton. And this is not me saying that this is better than Ragnarok. I do think that this film is thematically more cohesive than Ragnarok, because I think in a lot of ways that movie, it had to do more for the MCU. It was more tied in. It was leading into Infinity War. It had to deal with Hulk. And I don't think any of those things were to its detriment. I just think that it didn't have the, like, this movie feels like a Taika Waititi movie that is set in the MCU.
Ragnarok is not carrying as much thematic weight, for sure. Which is so funny, because this film, Love and Thunder, is the one that is painted as just a classic Thor adventure, and it's a space rom-com, and it's a joke, and it's a comedy, and so it gets written off. But actually, yeah, I think this is doing way more than Ragnarok thematically.
Because the whole film is asking the question that I think we're all asking coming into this, which is, what does it mean to be a god in the MCU? And it's one of the reasons why I like this falling where it does, because we've explored that a bit in Eternals. We've explored it a lot in Moon Knight, where we saw gods being either neutral and not involving themselves, or being actually kind of sadistic in their involvement, whether you're looking at Amet or Khonshu. And then now we pick right up with this opening scene of a god who not only doesn't care about the people that worship him, he actively disdains them. And is like, has zero mercy, doesn't care at all. All he cares about is his own glory and be able to sit and eat again fruit and be surrounded by all of these beautiful forest creatures, I guess, depending on how you look at it.
And I think that's the point of the orgy bit. That's the point of him going so over the top with Zeus being so unaware and Thor having to say, like, are you literally not hearing what I'm saying? You're uninvited to the orgy. It's like, dude, you're only so concerned with that you're not even listening to what I'm saying.
Well, and I think even Thor plays into that for the first half of this movie, right? Because
he's kind of one of those gods-ish.
Yeah, he's supposed to be helping people on this, the first planet that we find him on. And because he's going so over the top, destroys the entire temple. He's better than the god at the beginning and then Zeus, and that he is trying to help people, but he's still helping people in a way that's really self-serving because he just wants to have he wants to feel important and have the adventure and try to find meaning in that. And yeah, you're right. I think Omnipotent City is definitely supposed to be showing us that. Like, all of these gods are there. He can't get anybody to actually do something to help anybody but themselves. Not only because and this is the big choice. You could have done that in a way where it's more like Moon Knight, where they're playing it more seriously and they're like, oh, we can't get involved and this is not a matter for us to be a part of.
Good point.
And I could see some people saying, that's what I wanted. But I think what Taika does intentionally here is he doesn't want to give these characters even that much respect because he's trying to show how despicable it is and how indulgent this idea is that a god is supposed to be worshipped without providing anything in return.
Good point.
And so I think that it is. It's like, especially where in the MCU for the longest time, we didn't ever even refer to Thor as a god. Like the idea is he was an alien that was worshipped as a god because people were primitive at the time. But then we're starting to realize as of Ragnarok, we do have this language of him being the god of thunder and what does that mean? And Hel is the goddess of death. And so there are gods, which we then see in Moon Knight, like I said. So that's the question that this movie then answers, not just by contrasting Thor to these gods in Omnipotent City, but because of and this is where I'm just saying it's so thematically cohesive, because of the journeys we have specifically with Jane and Gore. Because the line, that scene that you talked about where Jane tells Thor that she has cancer, that not only is the turning point from it kind of being more of a comedy to something deeper, but it's also a turning point in the way that Thor, I think, starts to understand godhood. They have that conversation where he talks about Jane being worthy and Jane making him worthy. And I think that's the key to this whole movie for me, because if you go all the way back to the first film, it is Jane that teaches Thor what it is to sacrifice. And he gives up his own life at the end, or thinks he is, for her sake and for the sake of Earth. And it's this realization that it's Jane that makes Thor different from other gods, which, by the way, makes Jane such it really serves that character, and a character that I think has been really squandered for so much of the MCU. It gives Natalie Portman the chance to do something really incredible in this film. And it's what makes this movie such a powerful reframing of the entire Thor story from that first film all the way to here. Because she is the one that ultimately saves the day here, which is fascinating because it's a dying mortal that saves all the gods in the universe.
Not to mention just how unbelievable that is as a story choice, that every time she has to touch the hammer, she is strong, but it's killing her, and what that would be like for them. Oh, it's so good. Well,
I think it's the question that's being asked here between her and Gore. What do we owe to the gods and what do the gods owe to us, again, within the MCU? Because after the scene we talk about with Gore, he is left thinking that none of the gods actually care about anybody but themselves, which is kind of what we see up until that midway point. And then we start to see that, no, like there is a way, but the thing that actually makes you a god is a willingness to sacrifice yourself for your people, which is like a very, like, it's a really interesting take from Taika here.
This is heavy stuff. Oh, Robbie, just because bringing it.
You get to the end of the movie and you have Jane, first off, like, and I think this plays into why she goes to Valhalla and why she kind of turns into gold dust. She's the one that decides by even picking up the hammer to sacrifice her own life. Then you have Thor in that final moment, whenever they're there with Eternity. Thor chooses to reach out to Gore and in some ways sacrifice himself instead of trying to get Jane back somehow and that be the wish, or instead of just killing Gore like a prior version of Thor might have. Thor kind of sacrifices his own happiness for Gore. Like, he takes a moment there at the end and shows Gore what it is to choose love, like they talk about, and to bring his daughter back instead of going the violent path, or instead of, again, Thor trying to figure out a way to bring Jane back. And so then finally, it's like, because of what Thor has learned from Jane, he is now, in the same way that we saw him at the end of Ragnarok, learning what it is to really be a king and what that can look like, learning that it can actually be a really beautiful thing to be a god that gives of yourself and gives things up for your people. And then seeing Gore understand that, and Gore, who has hated gods rightly for everything that he's seen them do to him and to others, having that moment with Thor and Jane, because Jane's the one that ultimately says Thor can take your daughter. And then there's a beautiful moment there, to your point, with Christian Bale's performance, where it's like, it really is this crazy full circle moment for me, where like Taika is he's exploring something that I don't think any other Marvel film has ever even tried or would ever even try to touch. And I think doing it remarkably well in a comedy.
The ending is jaw-droppingly good. I can't emphasize this enough. It's one of the best things they've ever created, that shot in Eternity. Mm-hmm. Once you go on the journey you just talked about, I think Thor and Jane's acting is way undersold here. How Thor basically has very little to say for the first time ever. How about the fact that, yes, Thor now chooses love instead of violence for the first time ever. He doesn't have to beat him. And then I love the subtlety in the beauty of Jane coming up with a catchphrase, but then us not hearing it. And then Thor just kissing her and saying, it's perfect. And they both have a laugh. Like, I'm getting sad right now. And then the beauty of, like you said, Gore seeing that, it profoundly impacting him to where he changes his mind on what he's going to do. And then getting to see his daughter again. And then I get so sad thinking about the life they don't get to live now. Like, it's mm-hmm. so beautiful. And then my Enneagram 7 is like so heartbroken at the fact that now they don't get to do this. So similar to Interstellar, which is so funny because they referenced Interstellar earlier, but like the same feeling at the very end of that film, where now the life is not going to be shared. But then Gore getting that moment at least at nothing else. And then still, yes, getting a moment with Thor to be like, please watch over her. Like she's going to have no one. That's literally what he says, which is so sad to me as a father. Mm-hmm. And then even the way Thor then embraces that with the pan flaps, all that's perfect. Like that's normal humor.
Yeah.
That's normal. Like Thor, yeah. Like you said, that's Thor humor from Dark World, where it would totally fit. Like, and as an audience, you can totally buy into that at that point. That's an emotionally healthy Thor now, a self-aware Thor at now he's in a different place and he has to parent. I just think, and then the way Jane dies and Thor just like, he's kind of holding her, and because she turns into dust, his hands kind of just drop and he's on his knees. And it's just like, he's got a tear in his eye, but he's not like weeping. It's like an acceptance of what he knows has to happen because of the decision she made. But he also accepts why she had to make that decision. And so like when she shows up and he says, Jane, no. But then I love, there's not a big disagreement after that. Like now it's done. Now she already made the decision. So now we have to, you know, solve this. So even before that, it's handled perfectly. Cause there's another route where like he could have been like, Jane, you can't be here. Like you shouldn't do this. Whack, whack, whack. Why don't you go back? Smack. Boom. You know what I mean? Like that could have been a version. Instead, for him to just be like, oh no. Like that's when it hit him. So then by the time she's actually dying, it's just acceptance to him. I can't emphasize enough. The ending of this movie is perfect. This movie, I watched it on an airplane. I had legitimate tears coming down my cheeks. And I thought to myself, like, dude, first of all, I don't cry very much. So there are very few movies that can actually move me to tears. Mm-hmm. And there's something about this one that makes me cry. And so I texted you and said, I'm actually full out weeping on this airplane. And I it's so hard to explain because this is the comedy. This is the goofy movie. Why is this the one? And I looked it up and I was going through my list. I legitimately think that there are only, I want to say 3 to 5 films in the MCU that actually get me so choked up that tears can come to my eyes and I have to like fight it off if I don't want to be crying in the spot that I'm in. And that's crazy because there's a lot of times that I say, this makes me sad, but very rarely is it actually so powerful that it moves me to tears. And I just think it has to be noted that this movie does that.
I was really struck by like that scene with Eternity has always stood out to me, but this last time, the final scene, well, with Gore's daughter, I love that the whole movie Gore is talking about how there is no eternal reward because that's what his God told him. And he never got there. It's all been a lie, but ultimately there is an eternal reward. There's a reward literally from eternity in the form of his daughter coming back. And that's beautiful to me. But then the way that carries forward in that Thor now is watching over her in the way that a god should watch over his people, but also teaching her to be a god that watches over other people. And it's like this really beautiful subversion of the kind of state of the world that we're given at the start of this film.
How about also bringing it full circle with actual love and thunder being the last two words of the film? And we never projected that love and thunder meant him being thunder and his daughter being love.
Well, and the fact that he winds up with Mjolnir again.
Yes.
Like, and what that now means, I love that. Like, even again, going back to Endgame, where you have that scene of Thor being like, no, you take the little one, I get the big one with Cap. And like the fact that he's giving her Stormbreaker because he wants Mjolnir because of what it means to him, but also I think in large part because of how it's connected to Jane and how beautiful that is and what that means to he and Love's relationship. And so it's like all of that works. Like, this is what I mean. Like, the more you dig into this movie, there's so much more than we have time to get into that. I feel like we'll have to do like an overflow Friends from Work Plus episode on some of this. But like, I really do think if you go back through and watch this movie and look for this stuff, it is remarkable how everything serves like the central kind of motif from Taika.
Okay, so full disclosure, a little Wizard of Oz behind the curtain type stuff. We didn't stick to our time limit. We had a hard out, but we didn't make it. And so we came back and we punched some more stuff on Thor Love and Thunder because we just love it so much and we got to get all this across. And we lost the file. And so here we are 2 days later doing that same punch in addition to this episode. I hope you can give us a little bit of grace, but we're back with a few more Thor Love and Thunder thoughts. Robbie, I know we cut out when you were in the middle of a thought, so I'll let you take it away.
Which I just is so good because I haven't really gotten any of my thoughts across in this
right.
episode yet.
You didn't have a chance in the first hour.
I mean, you barely let me talk. Here's the fun thing about us losing that recording that I didn't tell you is I went by my local comic book store yesterday to pick up the new releases, and one of the new releases there was this guy.
Oh, wow.
And
is that
these sticky notes
on vinyl?
No, it's I've never seen one of these. I'm sure some of our listeners have, but it's a Marvel Studios official movie special. I've also got this one now. Come next week.
Center it up. I couldn't see it. Move it over.
Here we go.
Oh, wow. Loki.
So I've never read any of these, but they're really great. It's like basically just a hardcover, like little mini compilation of interviews that Marvel Studios has done with like the main cast members and head of makeup and visual and costume and
that's
here
cool.
It's Taika. Yeah, so it wound up being a really great one. It was really affirming because I actually feel like a lot of what we covered in the first chunk of this episode really matches up with especially with what Chris and Taika were saying they were going for here.
Oh, that makes me happy.
But also it was just a fun, so I got a couple little things that I can point out, but I think most of them, a lot of them we already kind of hit on. So
it looked like a vinyl cover from my view. Sorry, but yeah.
No, it is like it's a pretty thin book. But I think I would recommend these if people can find them at a good price. They're like really high quality stills all through here. And like a lot of Andy Park, which is fun. Friend of the pod.
So
really great experience. And man, I guess this is a good way to kind of start the summary here. I just am so convinced, having gone through this, there is a tendency to think that because of especially the way Taika carries himself, that
right.
all of this is just kind of an afterthought and he's just having fun and he doesn't really care and he's just like phoning it in or something. And
good point.
He is an improvisational filmmaker and they like everyone that's interviewed here make some comment about that, but almost everyone in here also makes a comment about how invested he is and how much of a genius he is and how he like really wants to get in the middle of it and how much him playing Korg is kind of part of that because he gets to be in the scene and almost direct from within it and kind of see what it needs being there, like interacting with Chris and Natalie and Tessa. And so again, I always want to say like, this is not to guilt people if they didn't like the movie. Like if you don't like the movie, you don't like the movie. But I really don't think the narrative that Taika just kind of came in and like left a fire in the MCU because he didn't really care is false. And I also think that from the MCU perspective, like we just talked about a while in the first chunk of this, he talks several times in this, like in the interviews here, about how much fun he had in the MCU with Ragnarok, how much that universe specifically is kind of fertile soil for someone that is as imaginative as he is, because it's kind of just, it's endless where you want to go with that. And so he talks about how much this movie he wanted to, like we talked about a lot, especially when it first came out, how it's not really connected to like the multiverse saga, which is true.
Right.
But he was intent on expanding the MCU tonally and visually and like even kind of geographically, and how much he's wanting to show different locations and different ways that people interact across, like when you're looking on Omnipotent City or Endgar. So
you don't add that tiny detail of the Celestials unless you know that stuff. Isn't that crazy that as they're leaving the city, you see those two Celestials like, and they're exactly visualized the same.
And I love that in our watch order, it's such a great follow-up coming, you know, just two projects after Eternals. But I'm glad that you brought that up too, because that's another thing that I think Taika has done since Ragnarok. Like, he's always leaned into the Jack Kirby imagery in a way that I think is really cool. Mm. Like, the not only the Celestials, but also, like, in that final scene, you see a couple of shout-outs of sort of classic Jack Kirby cosmic beings. I'm pretty sure you can see the Watcher at one point you look closely. Yeah, and even, you know, I had thought about this all through, you know, every time I've seen the film, but especially looking at some of these costumes, like, it's clear that he's going for some of these kind of hard, angular line designs that Jack Kirby loved so much. Mm. And that's another fun thing, is like reading up from the costume folks' perspectives. Like, they incorporated, I think they said every suit Thor has worn, at least in the Thor movies. I think at one point, maybe in the part where he's running and that we saw in the trailer, that's maybe the Avengers costume. But, like, they worked all that in and brought in elements of that for Jane's suit to make her look like Thor. And so my point being, like, there was a lot of thought and all of that, like, Chris was a part of, because he, and that's the other thing here, he feels so passionately about always taking this character further, but also he really identifies with the character and is always kind of putting more of himself into it. Mm-hmm. So it's just, I really think that a lot of thought went into so many elements of this movie.
Right. And some of the public perception is that it's the exact opposite, that no thought went into it. It was all willy-nilly. And yeah, that's what's so funny. Yeah. It's way deeper than it comes across on the surface.
That came across, especially in the interviews that I read with Natalie and Tessa, because they talked about how much it's this, like, constant genre shifting between, like, Jane specifically, or Natalie specifically talks about the scene with Jane and Thor on the boat when she tells him she has cancer.
That's the moment I was talking about.
And she talks about how it's like one of the silliest moments, both, like, visually, and they're talking about the dolphins and some of the kind of, like, awkward humor, and also one of the heaviest moments in the MCU, like, juxtaposed. And that's what we talked about Taika doing so much. But she pointed out, which I loved, and Tessa said something really similar, that the beauty of that is they were trying to convey what tragedy actually looks like in real life, and how normally it is always coupled with this kind of dark humor that people either use to deflect, or people will use because, like, that's the only way that you can cope. And so this sense that it's not, I mean, it's Jane and it's Valkyrie as well, but especially Thor, if we're kind of looking at his journey, it really is this, like, he starts off, and like we talked about with compensating, he's trying to figure out who he is and where he belongs. And I love, like, looking at that through each stage of this movie, where it's like in the start, he's trying to be very, like, Guardian-esque, and that doesn't work. And so then he goes hardcore, like, he, like, even the costume changes. Again, not to harp on that, but, like, whenever he goes to see Sif, and he does, it's like the big furry, like, it's very kind of like Viking classic Thor in a certain way. And then whenever he sees Jane in her Thor outfit, he famously, like, goes way over the top. And it's like he's constantly looking for something, and he's constantly trying to, again, like, deflect and find meaning and figure out, like, where he can actually be at peace and fulfilled. And so I think that moment really is, like you said, the crux of the movie, because it's like a great example of even them when she tells him, and he's like, wait, what is happening? And then it finally starts to move into a place where he's not posturing and she's not posturing. And it's like you start to see people, even Valkyrie's character in that scene where she's talking with Korg, kind of be honest with each other. So
Taika knew that he couldn't tear Thor down again. And I love that he accepts that, embraces that, and instead of tearing him down, in a different and unique way actually builds him back up through this movie, but it's not through a power or strength thing. And that's what I think is the clutch decision, is that the whole movie hinges on him finding himself. And in him finding himself, he chooses love instead of strength, which is such a unique take for Thor. That's what I think ultimately the movie does so well.
There's one little blurb from Taika on that that I just wanted to read a bit of.
Oh gosh, I love this.
So
we have facts.
He says, right? Look, we're really like,
we have receipts. Here we go.
He says, it strikes me that Thor, out of any of the other characters in the MCU, has lost the most. He's lost both parents and his brother. He lost his hammer and he lost his home planet. And now his people are refugees and stuck on Earth. I think the only thing really left for him at this stage is to reflect on everything that's happened to him. The way he deals with it and deals with these ghosts and demons and all this emotional baggage is to try and see it as some sort of big cosmic joke, where in a way nothing matters because we're all eventually destined to be leaves and dust. I think what he's trying to do is find a way to deal with all that sadness and anger, because he's probably realized that resorting to violence and just dealing with your emotions through your fists or by using an axe doesn't really make you feel any better later on. Yeah, it's a little bit of relief while you're fighting and if you're victorious, but then it's like chasing the dragon. You always want more. And so he's trying to figure out ways of dealing with all of this trauma through peace and silent meditation. And that's kind of where we find him at the start of the film.
Or maybe this.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think that's fair.
Wave the flag. Dude, and that guy doesn't care. Right? He just made a joke movie that no one cares about.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. And the more I thought about this, both while I was watching it and talking with you and then like reading through here, it's just, it really is, I think, it's becoming one of my favorite MCU projects.
He's out there.
Which is loud and proud. Again, I totally see some of the concerns people have, and I'm not negating those, but I just think for me, the story he's trying to tell, like maybe you could say he was, if anything, I think you could say he was too ambitious in everything he was trying to make happen.
Yeah, and that's perfect that you said that for me, because the more and more I watch this, the further I get away from it, the faster it climbs up my rankings on the preference side of things as well. And for a long time, there was a chunk of films from Phase 4 that all kind of fit into the same mold for me. I had a really hard time in my rankings deciding films like 12 through 17, because it was Love and Thunder and Black Widow and Quantumania and Shang-Chi. And so many of these fell in the exact same spot where I'm like, they're good, but they're flawed. But now for me, the more we talk about it, Love and Thunder is kind of rising to the top of that, where it's like getting close to threatening my top 10. And yes, that sounds shocking, right? But I think I agree with everything you're saying. For me, Quantumania, Love and Thunder, and Black Widow, where I just don't really care what the public perception is. I like them so much. And I think I have a legitimate argument/case to be made for why I think people are missing the mark on those films. And so I'm with you on that too.
Back in 2019, when the Gore and Jane of it all was first announced, I was really worried that this would wind up being a Ragnarok retread, because, you know, we had already gotten the Unworthy Thor stuff there, which comes from the Jason Aaron comics that he was then going to be adapting here. And I was worried, like what you said, that we would get Thor being like beaten down more, because that is sort of the whole point of the Gore storyline and eventually Jane taking over in the comics. But what I love now that I've seen this and kind of had a year to reflect on it, it's not a movie about breaking Thor down. Like we just said, Taika understands that we've already seen that play out in virtually every way. So instead, we see Thor on the search for meaning that his mother sent him on, which is to say, for people that think that this is some kind of like wild left turn, it really is coming right out of Endgame. And that's something that Chris talked about too when I was reading his interview. We see him trying to find meaning in his role as a hero, as a guardian, as a god. And so it's like you get this tour of Thor trying to play the hits, and it's like he tries to play the hero again at the top, but it kind of rings hollow to the point where it's almost tongue in cheek. He tries to play teammate to the Guardians, which is again funny because it's like it's almost like he's trying to get back the dynamic that he had with like Cap and Tony, but that can't be recaptured, which is something else we've kind of talked about phase four meditating on in general. And so that's not the right fit. And it comes off as desperate. So he thinks that he can then ultimately find meaning in his role as a god. And you see him kind of be energized by that and by energized by the mission to Omnipotent City. But then he gets there and the god that he's always looked up to the most turns out to be this kind of pompous buffoon. And so none of these roles are enough to bring Thor back. And I think what I ultimately really love about this movie is that it's Jane who first transformed Thor from the arrogant prince to someone truly heroic in the first film. It's her that ultimately shows him who he really is by showing him what it means to sacrifice everything out of love and for the sake of love. And I think that there's a really beautiful symmetry there. Like, even if you go back to that first scene whenever he kind of becomes worthy again, and they talk about that explicitly on the boat, but it's this like, what a powerful moment for Natalie's Jane character and a powerful moment for Thor, and just a way of like, I do think now if we never got another outing from Thor, I would be sad because it's a character I really love. But I really feel like this is a beautifully like symmetrical story kind of all around, because like what Taika's talking about and like what we've talked about all the way back to Infinity War and Endgame, the Thor that had always thought he could solve everything with this kind of like angry vengeance, and he's always going back to like get retribution. Like, he is now at the very end of this movie, he's actively choosing not to stop Gore from walking up to eternity, because he could easily overpower him at that point. He doesn't have the sword. Instead, he's choosing to sit with Jane and to try to speak out of love to Gore, which all then culminates with him literally serving Gore, who is the guy that thought gods don't care about anybody but themselves, by taking care of his daughter. And again, like, really giving him a literal eternal reward. So I think I love that now we are left with this Thor that knows who he is and what he stands for and what's actually going to give him meaning. And maybe that's all super cheesy, but that is not something that I think the average Marvel movie has even been interested in trying to do. Like, that's why I say this is a Taika Waititi movie that is set in the MCU. And again, to kind of go all the way back, I get why some people would not love that, but for me, it winds up being really powerful as a standalone thing and as a chapter.
It's kind of becoming a little bit like Infinity War and Endgame, where I say Ragnarok is a tighter film. I don't have some of the concerns, but as I listen to you talk about that, I'm not sure it's even trying to do nearly as much as what this film's trying to do. Okay, let me talk here for a quick second. I have tiny little notes that I need to close out this episode with, just things that I have to get in here, otherwise I'll be bummed that I didn't say it. We talk so often about how this movie's a comedy, and I think in some ways, comedy's almost become a bad word for some people. Like, it's almost become a negative, oh, it's just a comedy, it's a joke movie, and I understand where they're coming from, but I just don't want people to miss that when the comedy lines up with your sense of humor, it is so funny. So there are still so many funny things in this film. I wrote a couple of them down. I still think it's one of the funniest decisions, the way they edit it, the way they shoot it, the timing of it, to have the axe be like a human being. So every time Thor is like, here, boy, here, Mjolnir, here, Mjolnir, here, boy, and then the axe just slowly comes in the camera. And like the first time he just looks at it, the second time he grabs it, is like, what? We're just talking. Relax. And like almost every time where that happens, it makes me laugh. The one that I think is so funny, when he's way overcompensating with this egregious bravado early on, and he's talking with Chris Pratt's Star-Lord, and I wrote it down because we missed it last time. He's like, I always keep people an arm's length away, and then Chris is too far away, so he steps forward and touches him. Then he goes, this is the line, though. This is the line. You've grown too attached, damn it. You must go. And then Chris right away goes, okay, we'll go. And as he says that, he goes, shh, I know it hurts. He's like, all right, we'll leave. Yeah, we're out of here. I know it hurts. And then the temperamental lass from you're giving me my ship. She's a temperamental lass, but you know, it's really funny when it's funny.
Well, and I remember you and I talking about this in our Ragnarok episode way back, but it's so fun to me to read these actors that are so talented, like Christian Bale or Kate Blanchett, or obviously Natalie and Tessa, talk about how just insanely funny Chris Hemsworth is.
Yeah, everyone says that.
Which I love, because I really do think so much of that is coming from him. Like, I think that's why he and Taika work so well together, is they have a really similar sense of humor.
I love Chris's humor in that he comes across as one of these guys that doesn't have to try hard to be funny. I just need to reiterate how unbelievably unique and creative and incredible the Shadow Realm fight visuals are. Mm-hmm. The idea to have it all be black and white, because color can't even escape this black hole of sorts, and yet the super weapons that they have just enough power to get some of the color out. And so there's this like incredible shot of Valkyrie flying through the sky and like coming down with the lightning bolt. And all you can see is the lightning bolt lit up. And it's so cool. And mm-hmm. the way Mjolnir is used as like a flashlight for Jane in this black picture, it's so cool. As I said, from that moment where she explains her cancer, I just think the movie is unbelievable from that point on. And the Shadow Realm fight is a huge part of that. I want to follow up with my final little tangents on why I think the film isn't perfect. I know people know this, but I do think the film could have benefited from 10 minutes more of gore time. So if gore is going around and killing a bunch of other gods, I just wish we saw that. Mm-hmm. Not only, I think, would we have gotten a little more from Christian Bale as an actor and allow him to stretch his acting wings a little bit, I also think that character could have used just a slight more development, like to see how much that sword is poisoning him.
Mm-hmm.
Just a little bit more time there, I think also would have added to the dread of like, oh gosh, what is Gore doing? Now they do give you some dread, like when he shows up at New Asgard, but I wish I felt that even more from like, oh my goodness, this guy is capable of murdering gods and you're next. So I think that's one thing. I do think the first 10 minutes or so of the film are perfect. And like I said, the back from 71 minutes on, the back, whatever that would be, 50 minutes or so are perfect. Mm-hmm. I do think there's a middle chunk where a little bit wanders and gets a little bit too goofy with some of the jokes, and like the floating head thing, right? We talked about this in the original episode, the axle. Like, we still to this day don't understand why that had to be a running joke that Heimdall's kid had to be named Axel now. I get that they're trying to do the Guns N' Roses thing.
This time, still can't fit. I mean, other than, the obvious connection, but right. I don't.
That one kind of misses the mark. And the floating head in general, why did that have to be the visual? Because they're actually talking about a very serious moment. And I don't think like you need to even point out that Axel, like him learning his father's powers could be a cool moment, not a joke moment.
Well, no, that is interesting, because it's not like we got a floating head in Ragnarok when we had him communicating with Heimdall.
Korg's head being strapped on the back of Valkyrie, I just think those are Taika moments where I go, you're just missing a little bit. Like, come back, just come back two steps. Like, we don't need that idea.
I think that like there are certain, and you know, again, what's interesting about this movie specifically, I think there are elements of Multiverse of Madness that have this too, some of the things that I walk away from thinking, like that's a little much, are some of the other things that friends of mine loved and like thought was so funny. Like I feel like the bow god I could kind of take or leave.
Correct.
But I know people that really liked that moment, and they thought it was really cute.
My wife loves it, and I actually think I would take it out of the film. I'm like, I don't need to be pulled out that ridiculously. Right. Veronica's like, no, he's so cute and it's funny. I'm like, okay, what? I mean,
and sometimes, you know, what I like is I'll come back and watch it, and something will hit me a little bit differently. So like, I don't love the like Bluetooth speaker gag with Valkyrie and Jane.
Correct. Because it also comes right after the bathroom scene. Like,
right.
Again, right. Which, it's the positive and negative of the crazy juxtaposition. Sometimes it misses for me. Sometimes it really hits, like the cancer line, you know.
And, I do think that there's a case to be made that that is a real, like, it's an intentional choice in that they are choosing to joke instead of acknowledge the elephant in the room.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think it's also, like, And you know, it's if you step back from it, it's kind of just a fun, like, this is a chance for Jane to like be goofy in that way. And
which is why it doesn't ruin the film for me. But
right.
But I'm pointing those things out that I think I would have made a different decision there. That's all.
Yeah.
And I've said this,
there are several moments like that for me.
I've said this a gajillion times. I don't know how much this already made the episode because we had to redo it. I just need to reiterate this one last time. When the movie is powerful, it's powerful to the highest degree. It's a top three MCU film as far as it moving me for whatever reason. And like Thor having the conversation with Jane in the hospital is a very moving scene to me. Then we talked about the end with Eternity and how moving that is for me. So when it works, it's not just that it's working. It's like the payoff is extremely good. So that's why I think it's moving up my rankings.
I totally agree. And one thing that I also would not have gotten to do if we didn't have to re-record this, I wound up getting to go see The Dark Knight in theaters the other night.
Oh,
they were showing it at Alamo in Austin.
That's random.
And it was so fun. Just I've only ever seen that the one time that in theaters the one time. And so just to go back and it's like a fun way to experience that movie. And it was the same day that we had recorded the first part of this episode. And I think so many people would consider The Dark Knight to be the best superhero movie of all time. I think you could argue whether it is in fact a superhero movie, but I thought it was really interesting. A movie that's so dark that like does have a couple of funny moments in it, but generally not super interested.
Yeah. Right.
Like in contrasting these two movies that are both comic book movies that I love so much and could not be more different. And it just, I came away thinking like, yeah, I love both of these a lot. This is not me saying Thor: Love and Thunder is as good as The Dark Knight. I think my point is just those are both rooted in comics. Like I could go through and show you what both of those movies come from, but they are adapted by such different filmmakers. And I think that that's incredible. Like, I don't want that's what's made the MCU so fun over the years is that we don't need a Guardians movie to be the same as a Captain America movie.
The Dark Knight is unbelievable. But if we had 30 Dark Knights at this point or 30 Winter Soldiers, we'd be like, okay, can we?
Right.
You know, plus everyone would be crushing Marvel for their formula. Last two final things. Here we go. On the deaths front or quote unquote deaths front. I'm thankful that they kind of pulled the rug out on the Valkyrie thing. Like, I'm thankful she didn't die. I think that's the right call because I think she's an unbelievable character, badass character. And I think there's a lot of room for her. Like, there's a subtle shot at the very beginning of the film where it's showing her being the president of, or the king of Asgard. Mm-hmm. And she's kind of like just not fulfilled by it. Like, she's a warrior. She doesn't want to be sitting there doing the red tape stuff. And I thought that's kind of a genius thing. Like, we could explore that more. Like, what does that look like for her to turn that over to somebody else? Or does Asgard need a king like that anymore? Like, there's a lot there. So I think she's a badass, a great actor, and I just want her in the MCU. So I'm thankful they didn't actually kill her there. I just
will
be crushed if Jane comes back.
Oh,
Jane's story is so perfect, and they tied in these first two films in the best way possible. If for some reason there's a storyline where you can get her out of Valhalla and she can come back, that's a huge mistake. Huge mistake. That one, I'll die on that hill.
No, I agree with that. And I do. I also agree with what you're saying about Valkyrie. And I like that. I haven't really thought about it that way before, but it makes me appreciate even more the final scene where we show her like teaching all of them how to fight. Cause it's like, that is like in, and you see, I mean, she's like smiling and it's such a, it is a contrast from the way we saw her being a king at the beginning of the film. And this feels like in the same way, like what I'm saying, like in the same way that Thor is kind of finding what actually fulfills him, you're kind of seeing at least a hint of Valkyrie finding that in her role.
Good point. And then these last two, I can take or leave. Korg, you know, there's an argument I think that could be made, and it's probably pretty uninteresting, to be honest, but I think there's an argument that could be made that what if Korg had actually died when Zeus hit him with the Thunderbolt and he actually ceased to exist? But obviously the other side of it is, yes, he does bring about some cool parts towards the end of the film as far as like some character development with Valkyrie, things like that. So I could see both sides of it, but there's a part of me that wonders if it could have been a really moving thing and a serious thing to actually lose Korg there. And then I partially wondered, do we need him in the future? Like, do I need him in the next Avengers film? Probably not. Like, that character is what it was, you know, but I understand the argument on both sides. So I could take or leave that one. And then I can kind of take or leave the Zeus one. Like, for a while, I thought, wow, it'd be pretty powerful if Thor actually kills him and he falls to his death. Also kind of wondering, like, man, how did he survive that? But I don't know. What do you think about the very end, the post-credits scene? Do you think we need Zeus as a character going forward, or could it have just been passed down to Hercules? I'm kind of undecided on that.
I think I like it because it feels like an almost meta reaction to what Taika knew people would think about the goofy Zeus. Like it, and you could say, well, if he was aware of that, then should he have just not made him so goofy? And that's a different conversation. But I like that, like, the line is, when did we become the joke? And talking about how the superheroes are basically taking the role that gods used to have. And it's like, I think that that's actually really interesting because the whole movie is making fun of gods, and you're only ever seeing them for the most part as like comically awful. And so this idea that he is aware of that, and that it like took this interaction with Thor to now kind of like, I mean, the performance or delivery of just those few lines from Russell Crowe is so dramatically different from the way he talks through the film. So I think I like how it sets up to the next Thor outing, if we get one, because I think Taika, what he's doing here is really opening up the MCU to a whole line of Thor stories that I don't know that I ever thought we would get. I mean, like, so much of the classic Thor stuff is like these scenes of him wrestling with Hercules, or like dealing with like primarily mythological, like other, like either people from other mythologies or Norse mythologies. And we've kind of had so much of Thor as an alien that, you know, I could see some people being more comfortable with that because it fits more within the more grounded MCU to some degree. But I like now that like there's a reason why we're moving in that direction. And we were able to get across the theme Taika wanted in this film about gods, but also like maybe set that up and develop it even more if someone were to come in and take this in a different direction. Like, I actually think it's kind of Taika like putting that out there for someone else to come and pick up. So I think I like
that's
it.
That's a good point.
I like it's grown on me, I'll say.
Okay.
I like that's it. Point. That's one that, like, to your point, I would like to follow up on that. I do hope that we don't really get any follow up on the Valhalla post credit scene.
Yeah,
both because of what you said and for Heimdall, like that was a meaningful death that I don't want to see undone.
I'll do you one further. I'm with you. Not only do I not want them to come back to life, I don't think I even want any more shots of Valhalla. Like, I don't want it to start becoming this idea that there's another reality that they're just living in.
Right.
Like, leave that to our imaginations, I think. A perfect closing summary to everything we've talked about over these last almost 2 hours now, going way back to something I said, this film makes me so choked up that I have to fight back tears. If I'm willing to let those go, I will actually cry at this movie. But if I'm fighting it back, then it's at least a strong, you know, lump in your throat trying not to think about the sad things. And that is really rare. What makes you cry in the MCU, or at least get to that point? And this is a safe space. There is no judgment from me. All of our listeners, what makes you cry in the MCU, legitimately cry? And again, it's a safe space. Like, no one can tell you you shouldn't be crying at this one thing. This is truly your personal experience. For me, it's Endgame, when Tony dies, but really stretched out through that entire funeral. And as you've told me off air before, the cheeseburgers line that Morgan has with Happy. So that's one. For me, it's Take My Hand, Peter, in the middle of the chaos at the end of Guardians 1. So that'd be two. It's No Way Home for me when Peter is saying goodbye to MJ and Ned and Doctor Strange, more than when Aunt May dies in particular. That's three. It's this movie at the very end in Eternity. That's four.
Yeah.
WandaVision for sure, when she is having the conversation with her kids and with Vision as he's about to disappear. So that's five. Am I missing any for you? Or do you disagree? Or just add. Don't disagree. Just add.
Yeah. So I think maybe unsurprisingly, there have been times where the plane going down scene in the first Avenger gets me. And I think that's because
it's a safe space.
I think Evans and Atwell's performance there specifically is really great, paired with the first time we have that Silvestri melody, which we talked about in our Mount Rushmore Composers episode on Friends from Work Plus that will be coming out soon. As I'm kind of going through the watch order here, I think that's the only one until maybe phase.
Okay, I just remember this deep cut. You told me this off air too. Do you remember? This is deep cut. Falcon Winter Soldier.
Oh, yes, a little bit. Well, I'm just thinking, I'm trying to go in order and see if there's anything before. Yeah, I think so.
For both of us, that's when Isaiah Bradley is seeing his memorial or whatever at the
whenever they go to the Smithsonian, that one will get me.
Yeah.
WandaVision gets me as well. Yeah. Endgame, it's the cheeseburger line. It's Gwyneth Paltrow's little like gasp whenever Tony says, "I love you 3000, and then the recording cuts off. That kind of gets me.
I actually always get a little bit sad too. Like, that lingers for me. Like, the cheeseburger line bleeds into Wanda and Hawkeye's conversation and her being like, "Yeah, I wish they were here.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I could tell them." So, yeah. Keep going.
I'm trying to think what else. Most of them are phase four, like No Way Home. The Aunt May death is the one that will get me.
That's interesting.
Wakanda Forever will get me either at the top or at the back end. Like, especially when she's burning the funeral garments and we get all of the shots of Chadwick, that gets me. I think WandaVision, yes. You know, one thing that, like, I don't think it's quite brought tears, but it has gotten me, like, weirdly emotional before, is just the final shot from Black Widow, like, where it's, like, showing the fireflies.
Oh, okay.
And I just think that's a really beautiful way to close that movie and to deal with the reality of, like, it coming out after the character has died, but not... without it being like a massive flashback movie or something. Like, I thought that was well done.
Oh, and I thought of one other. The Yondu funeral scene in Guardians 2.
That's the one. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. That's one of the ones that just every time.
For me, it's not Yondu actually dying. It's a shot like Kraglin seeing all of the other Ravagers show up, or the conversation that they're having around that funeral.
Yeah, I think, you know, we'll talk about this pretty soon because No Way Home is just a few stops along the way. We'll pause a bit for Loki, but then hopefully resume soon. But I think the thing that gets me, like, with that death is the sense that Peter, it's so perfect, and so I won't get all into it, but it's like that he has been so young the entire time we've seen him in the MCU. He's acted really young, and we've talked about that being something we want to see change now that he has kind of gone through this. But so like that moment hits in a way that I don't think the other Spider-Man adaptations did, even with Uncle Ben, for me, because it's like you do feel like the way Tom Holland's performance is everything there.
I mean, he's like so great, innocent and not ready for it. Like,
yeah,
he's such a kid.
And it's this like he thinks that he can still like get her to the hospital, that it's okay. And it's like coming off of the loss of Tony.
He does like the no. What's wrong? Yeah, that stuff.
I'm excited to talk about that movie because now I'm just thinking there's a lot to unpack, but not yet because we've got a super fun rewatch pre-watch combo episode coming next week.
The next 6 weeks are going to be absolutely massive here on Friends from Work. So if you're a longtime listener, I ask that you welcome new listeners back with a nice warm hug. Yes, we are shifting gears now entirely to Loki. So next week's episode will be a Loki season one rewatch. But if all goes according to plan, we also will probably have seen a couple episodes of season two. So we will tack on a spoiler-free preview after an ad break, so you can skip it if you don't want to hear anything about Loki season two, previewing that. And then we're in October 5th, which they heard us. They heard our complaints, everybody. It's happening. Let's play this. This is it. It's happening. Marvel is moving their release times to Thursday night at, I think, 6 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Central, 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. So what does that mean? All of us can finally be on the same page, having the same conversation, Samwise included, having the same conversation about this show that we love all at the same time. So you're not going to want to miss that. Loki now airing on October 5th at 8 p.m. Central. We cannot wait to help usher in that discussion.
So to get ready for that too, let's go ahead and set our final group watch of this leg of Phase 4 for 8 p.m. Central next week. And we'll watch the Loki Season 1 finale at that time. And that'll be a little dry run for the Loki Season 2 premiere at the same time next week, where I know Kyle and I will be, I think, watching it the moment it premieres. And hopefully, this is not something we've been able to do since the very beginning.
Get your minds right, people. Get in the Loki. Like, we just watched Thor. Get into Loki world. Get your minds right. My last pitch, real quick. I just finished and uploaded, surprise to you, you're going to love it, my friendly reminder of Loki season one. Ooh. So everything you need to know about Loki before season two in under 7 minutes on YouTube. I'll take you through all of it, clips included. It's really fun. So if you're going to be watching Loki season two and your significant other or a friend wants to watch it with you or something, and they haven't seen the first season of Loki or anything from the MCU, I take you back through where this character has been and hopefully catch you up in preparation for the air date of season two. So check that out on YouTube. It's going to be available this week. The friendly reminder, Everything you need to know. Thank you so much for listening. This has been an absolute mega episode. Throwback to our mega episodes of yesteryear. Thank you for listening. We love this film. We'd love to hear your thoughts. Hit us up at the FFW Podcast on all social media, our Discord, the website. You've heard all of it, but please rate, review, and subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Otherwise, we'll see you next time right back here on Friends from Work.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.